This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. How many times have you checked your phone today? And if the answer is too many, are you concerned it's affecting the way you live your life? This hour, we tackle the modern-day love affair with digital technology. Manoush Zomorodi is host of the WNYC podcast, New Tech City, which is launching a project called Bored and Brilliant, The Lost Art of Spacing Out. It looks at whether we are addicted to our phones, and if we are, what are we losing? Manoush, welcome to Radio Times.
Mary, it's great to be here.
Let's start off with your own story. Why are you launching this project?
Well, it sort of occurred to me a few months back that ever since I'd bought a smartphone, which was about 7 years ago, I wasn't really getting bored anymore. You know, standing in line at the coffee shop waiting to order, I was looking at my phone. Standing on the subway platform, I was looking at my phone. Hanging out at the playground waiting for my kids, looking at my phone. And I sort of started to wonder, I'm filling all the cracks of my day when I usually used to just sort of space out and let my mind wander. I was filling them with my phone, and I wondered if this was a problem. Was this a bad thing? Was it bad that I wasn't getting bored anymore? And so I sort of went on a little odyssey to figure out what happens when we do get bored, and I spoke to a lot of neuroscientists and psychologists and learned about the default mode, which is a part of our brain that goes into action when our body is not stimulated, but our mind is. It's working. It looks like we're doing nothing, but actually the default mode is working really hard, and it's coming up with our most original ideas. It does something called autobiographical planning when we think about what our goals are and how we can achieve them. It also does something positive constructive daydreaming, which is when we sort of take one idea that we've seen and another and we smash them together and come up with something new. So I started to think, well, I don't know how often I'm going into default mode, as it's called. Does that mean that my creativity is suffering in some way? And although the research, you know, it's really not there. It's very preliminary about how smartphones affect the default mode. So we thought, you know what, let's get people together and let's do some semi-scientific experimenting ourselves and see.
So being bored is a good thing?
Yeah, it's a really good thing, because after you're bored, that's when your mind tries to stimulate itself, and that's when it goes to weird and wacky places and comes up with novel ideas and decides, you know what, it's not just about what I'm doing tomorrow. It's what am I going to be doing in 10 years from now? It's really about giving meaning to all the interactions that we have all day long and deciding what do we want our life to look like? That seems pretty important to me.
So I know you know of the app called Moment, which is designed by a person called Kevin Holesh. It's designed to help figure out how much time we actually spend on our phones. And what he found, Manoush, is that he is, quote, addicted to being distracted. Does that ring true?
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah, I am using the Moment app, and actually New Tech City has partnered with Kevin and also with an Android app called Break Free. And what we're having people do is download the app. And right now we are in the observation phase. So we are asking people, don't change your behavior. Just do what you always do. See how you and your phone sort of commune. And I'm embarrassed to say that I am averaging between 60 to 180 minutes a day on my phone and picking up my phone, usually somewhere. A good day is 40 pickups. A bad day is like triple digits, Mary. It's pretty painful.
You're actually doing better than what the research group Flurry found. It found that the average American is on the phone just under 3 hours a day, which beats out television.
I mean, it's amazing, right? And this has happened so quickly. I think we know that social media is, of course, a big thing that they're doing. Texting is what they're doing. Games. There's just so many wonderful things to do. And I'm not saying that the phone is bad in any way.
Sure.
I love my phone, you know, but I want to use it mindfully. I want to use it without it being a reflex, because this happens to me. I'm walking down the street and I'm looking at my phone. I don't even know what I'm looking for. It just sort of happens now. I think that needs to stop, for me at least.
So the key is too much time on the smartphone hindering the creativity of Americans?
Precisely.
So, but boredom has gotten such a bad rap in this country. It really does. Do you think it's going to be an uphill battle to convince people to disengage?
Well, you know, we have over 11,000 people signed up now to do the challenge. So I think this is a self-selecting group. Maybe it's people who are think of themselves as creative and maybe don't feel as though they're tapping into their potential. Maybe it's people who just find that they are just too tied down. I mean, we have some preliminary information about the people who have signed up for this. And let me just be clear. So what's happening right now, we're in the observation phase, but it's next week. So starting on Monday, that 11,000 people, they will get a daily challenge. And the idea is that we start the week rethinking our relationship with our phone. So the first day, you're going to be asked to keep your phone in your pocket whenever you are going anywhere, if you are walking down the street or you are riding along in the carpool. And then as the week progresses, we're going to try and jumpstart creativity. So we have very specific exercises that we're going to ask people to do as the week goes on. And the idea is to be fun. You know, the idea is to, like, we don't want you to be bored and miserable, right? We want you to be bored and brilliant and to have a good time.
So let me jump in for a second. What sort of exercises to jumpstart creativity?
Okay, I'm going to go through it then. Monday is put it in your pocket day. This is when you're walking. This is about, like, breaking the reflexive habit of looking at your phone. Tuesday is the day when we ask you not to take a photo. So for some people, I think this won't be too hard if they're not big on taking photos, like, you know, my 70-year-old mother. But I think our average age is a 36-year-old. And these are people who are often on social media and posting a lot of pictures. If they're going somewhere, they're taking selfies maybe. So no selfies. You're just going to be in the moment today. You're just going to experience things. Then on Wednesday, we are asking you to delete that app that is driving you bananas. Just for the day, you might like it and might keep it off your phone. But I, for example, am going to delete a game that I have some issues with. And then Thursday is called a focation day, as in pretend vacation. We are writing templates for people to have that will out of office messages that will say, you know what, I'm in Bermuda today, or I have a meeting from 2 to 5. I will not get back to you. So really carving out time to either relax or to do a creative task of their choice, or maybe to just work because they don't get to focus. Friday is called One Observation Day, where we're asking people to observe and put themselves in a mindset of someone that they see out and about, because we know that when you think of, try to imagine what someone is thinking, your brain goes into default mode. And then the final day, the artist Nina Kachadorian is giving us a mystery assignment. I know what it is, but I can't tell you because I want it to be a surprise.
Sounds good. So are you asking people then to log their creative moments, whether it is a great idea for a project or, you know, oh, where there's a scene over there and maybe I'll sketch it?
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. This is a very active group of people, 11,000 of them again, and we're hearing from them about how excited they are to do this, even if we haven't done it yet. And the other thing we're going to be doing is we'll be looking at the data coming in from those two apps, from Moment and Break Free. And so I hope in our unscientific way, we'll be able to correlate, you know, wow, Tuesday's mission didn't really get people to spend less time on their phones. But wow, look at Thursday. Thursday maybe worked. And we want people to self-report and say, this worked for me. Carving out an hour every day where I have an auto reply message that says I'm not available, that worked for me. So I think it's going to be different for everyone. They're each going to have to set their own goal as to what feels right for them and what helps them sort of tap their creativity without them feeling like they're missing out in some way from their phone.
And Manoush, are you also going to look at human relationships? I mean, we all know the picture of two folks, friends, sitting side by side, and instead of conversing with each other, they're looking down and they're thumbing their friends.
Yeah, right? I mean, what's the point of getting together in person anymore? I really enjoy this. I did a great interview with a 16-year-old girl named Grace, and she sort of kept an audio diary. This was last week's episode on New Tech City. And it was amazing to me. She said, we all got together and then we were texting our other friend and then we took some selfies and then we got into group chat. And, you know, teenagers, for them, I think it's a seamless transition back and forth. I certainly do not have a seamless transition back and forth. So I am trying not to be on my phone when I am with someone who's right next to me. And in fact, there was a recent study that said that even just having the phone in the room with you was a distraction. You weren't looking at it. It wasn't even in front of you. Just knowing that it was there meant that you felt less empathetic to the person in front of you. Hmm. So it's interesting, the research that is starting to come out.
Kevin Holish says that he has found that he's been able to get down to about 50 minutes a day on the phone. And what he's doing is, instead of reading Twitter, he's just reading.
Yeah, shocking, right, Mary? Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting looking at our survey of, again, 1,000 people from the 11,000 who have signed up. 69% of them say they're doing this because they just don't have enough time to think. So I found that very, very interesting. And I think when we read a book on paper, I've done some reporting into this, we definitely are using a different part of our brain than when we are looking at it on a Kindle or an iPad. So I think people sense, that's the feeling that I'm getting, is that people sense that something is not the same or not right, or that they're not communing with the information as thoroughly as they wish they were, that they're going into skimming mode a lot of the time when they look at a screen. Mm-hmm. Whereas with a book, we understand that there are haptics that happen. The feel of the paper, knowing where something is, if you want to go back, where it was on the page, all of those things contribute to our comprehension and deep reading and thinking of material.
And again, this is not to knock digital technology. This is just perhaps it's a little too much of a good thing.
Yeah, you know, I sort of think of it as like smoking, right? Like we used to go out, or, you know, people back in the day used to go out for a cigarette smoke. Now you see people on the street kind of looking at their phones. Well, but here's the thing. You can quit smoking, right? But you can't quit your phone. We need it to exist in the modern age. I need it to know where my kids are. I need it to be in touch with my team.
Sure.
So I'm starting to think of it more as like food, like having a healthy diet. I think about what I eat, what makes me feel good, when I want to eat, what I want to eat. I'm thinking maybe we can apply some of this to how we use our technology too. And we haven't. We've just assumed like, here it is. It's good. Let's do it. But we don't know really yet. So let's experiment and see what feels right and good and healthy.
Okay. And quickly, too, you talked about skimming. Just if you could quickly address attention span. Today's, you know, there's a lot of joking about today's 10-second attention span. Anecdotally, do you think too much technology affects our ability to focus?
I mean, I just have no doubt in my mind. I mean, I see that in my kids and all the kids that they're friends with, the children. Today, what happens? And it's the adults. I blame the adults. If you go on an airplane and a kid starts crying, all the adults look at the parent like, give the kid a phone already. We are not used to kids being uncomfortable or bored in the bad sense of the word. We don't even give them a chance to pass through boredom to that place where I used to go as a kid, where I used to be bored and then go away and create something amazing out of, I don't know, toilet paper rolls, you know?
All right, Manoush, we're going to have to stop there. We're up against a break, but Manoush Zomorodi, host of the WNYC podcast New Tech City, will be back in a moment. Also, Keith Hampton is co-author of a Pew study, which has found Facebook can actually relieve stress for some of us. More on Radio Times coming right up. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, filling in for Marty Moskowane. Our guests today are Manoush Zomorodi, host of the WNYC podcast New Tech City. And also joining us for the remainder of the hour is Keith Hampton, an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Rutgers University. Keith is also co-author of a new Pew study, which has found that time spent online on Facebook or Twitter might not be all bad, and in fact, can reduce stress for some of us. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you, Mary.
And also for our listeners, we'd love to hear what you think about all this. 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do you feel the need to unplug? How do you feel about Facebook and Twitter? Let us know what you think. So, Keith, we're in a fast-paced age, obviously, and on top of that, many of us are consistently plugged in. This is widely seen as adding stress to an already overstimulated life. And yet the Pew study essentially says not so fast.
Right. I mean, I think that's exactly what we were expecting when we went into this study. The kind of common narrative is that the more time we spend on our mobile phones, the more time we spend on social media, doing email, that these things add up and contribute to stress in our everyday lives. So we really went out and tried to investigate that in a very systematic way. We did phone interviews with 1,800 Americans, and we interviewed them about their stress using a scale that tells us how uncontrollable they think their lives are or how unpredictable it is. And then we also asked them about their use of all these technologies. And very surprisingly, we found that these technologies didn't contribute to people's everyday stress for the most part, that for men in particular, there was no relationship between the use of these technologies and stress. But for women, the more they use some of these technologies, there was actually a report of lower levels of stress.
Why is that?
You know, it's a great question, and we don't know for sure. We have a few ideas of what might be happening here. The first might be just simply time use. I mean, we know that women in particular have a lot of competing demands in their lives. They're responsible for increasingly paid work, the majority of the homework. They also do a lot of the network. They maintain the relationships for the family and for the household. And using these technologies may just provide a very low-cost, accessible, easy way to manage those competing demands. Another might be that we know that there are a lot of benefits to using social media in particular, that our prior studies have found that people who use Facebook a lot report that they think they have higher levels of social support. So there could just be a situation here where some of the benefits are outweighing some of the costs. But the idea that I like the best is that some of these technologies, such as sharing photos through your cell phone, for example, they provide for very easy social sharing. And we know that social sharing for men and women, that is sharing both positive and negative emotional events throughout the day, is associated with lower stress. And using email to do that, using your cell phone to take a picture and send it off to a few friends and family may actually be responsible for some of that lower levels of stress.
And also the study found that there is one negative called the cost of caring.
Right. So this was a little bit of a surprise. So when we set out to do the study, we expected that we would find that as people saw their friends' wonderful lives and how successful their great aunt and friends from high school are and you know what a wonderful time they're having and how poorly your life is in comparison, that this might result in some level of stress.
Sure.
But for the most part, those things are probably fairly immediate and dissipate quickly. Instead, what we found was that, again, particularly for women, but also for men, that awareness of unfortunate things happening in the lives of friends and family, whether it's someone getting injured or someone losing their job or someone getting a demotion at work or something like that, that these types of events have always been associated with higher levels of stress. And social media in particular and mobile phones are giant awareness machines. They really do increase the volume of awareness around us. And when those things include an awareness of unfortunate events, that might result in higher levels of stress.
Manoush Zomorodi, what's your take on this?
Well, it's fascinating to me. It makes me wonder if the people who have signed up for the Bored and Brilliant Challenge, they are obviously a self-selecting group, and we know that they are 75% female, according to the survey that we have of them, of 1,000 of the 11,000 who have signed up. And they say that 42% of them say that my phone adds stress to my life. So it's very interesting to me that the majority of the population might not feel the stress, but that there is this group of people who are feeling it very acutely and who want to do something about it. I also just wanted to ask about the stress scale that was used. When I read the study that was done at Pew, I know that the stress scale questionnaire is a questionnaire that was created in 1983. And so I just wondered if perhaps the notion of what stresses someone out has changed in any way between 1983 and 2015.
Keith?
Another good question. So we used a measure called the Perceived Stress Scale, which is a very well-known and established measure of psychological stress. There is no evidence to suggest that how we feel or conceptualize stress has changed in the preceding decades. Stress is stress. But there is a big difference between asking someone in a question, you know, do you feel like your mobile phone is stressing you out? Because it's a loaded question, which people will often say it does. And it also doesn't provide for a kind of point of comparison. People are unable to tell what their lives would be without that technology, without, you know, past experience. So what we're able to do by changing this to a measure that focuses on really how uncontrollable people think their lives are. And we can compare it to people who use these technologies less, people who don't use it at all. And we know from that that people who are using these technologies are, in fact, not reporting everyday stress that's higher than anyone else.
Curious to know what our listeners think. Do you feel the need to unplug? How do you feel about your smartphone? What do you think of Facebook and Twitter? How does it affect your life? Our number, again, is 888-477-9499. And also, you can send us a tweet, if you like, at WHYY Radio Times. Keith, my understanding in doing some of this research is that stress is almost like a virus. It can be contagious online.
Yeah, it very is. And, you know, stress is like a virus in a number of ways. It's very unhealthy to start with. So stress has been associated with, you know, psychological disorders like anxiety and depression, as well as physical illnesses and susceptibility to everything from the flu to the common cold. But in addition to that, there is certainly some suggestion that stress is contagious. So when your friends and family go through unfortunate events such as, you know, falling off that roof, shoveling snow later today, or losing a job, that's very stressful for them. But once you're aware of that stress in the lives of friends and family, that induces stress in you. So it is certainly contagious in that sense.
And yet sometimes, it's very difficult to break away. When is it time to disengage?
You know, this is something that, you know, I certainly struggle with personally, and it's hard to tell. I mean, I do worry a little bit about the idea of saying to someone, you know, for a day, try not to take any pictures. For a day, don't check your email. Because for some people, that is a way of coping with stress. That is a way of sharing emotional events with people around you. And it really is for time management. And we know from time use studies that men and women are spending more and more time with their children today than they were in the past, and that's particularly true for fathers. And I suspect that some of that is a result of the use of technology and our ability to shift our time and to manage when we're using our technologies and when we're working so that we can spend more time going to soccer practices and going to the playground and being there for dinner, when in the past we might have had to stay at the office longer.
And yet it seems there is a need. I mean, as Manoush, you have, what did you say, 11,000 people who are signed up to take the challenge?
I mean, here's my issue, Keith, is what I'm wondering. Is that is very much talking about somebody's outer life, how they cope with stress and their connection to people and their social life and society. But what we're really talking about is connecting to the inner life, whether you have enough time to think. And as I said, almost 70% of the people said, I don't have enough time to think. And we didn't tie that to their cell phone usage. So just as people feel more stressed, but it's not because they're using their phone that they feel more stressed, as in your study, that it's because of they are more aware of some of the stressors in their people in their lives. Perhaps there's something that we can say that, you know, it's not because of their phone that they feel they have less time to think, but it is one of the sort of knock-on effects. And that inner life, that planning, that coming up with the novel ideas, that they don't feel they have enough time to do that because they are so connected.
Yeah, I mean, I see that for sure. I mean, there are, you know, I think good evidence to suggest that breaks from technology and breaks from everyday activities to focus on creativity and to give yourself time to daydream have a lot of benefits, and I wouldn't dispute that. That said, everybody likes a good moral panic, and I think that we've had moral panics about new technologies for centuries. Muslim scholars in the 14th century were writing about information overload, too many books. 100 years ago, we were concerned about this new phenomena of dads sitting at kitchen tables reading newspapers instead of spending time with their wives and their children. And I don't think much has changed. I mean, a new technology, a new moral panic, it's very hard to, you know, be able to look back in time and say, they had it so much better, we have it so much worse. The reality is that we tend to have more leisure time today than we had in the past. And we also, you know, tend to benefit from that. So it's difficult to say that, you know, things were worse then, but we always want it better.
And I guess I just wonder if we can use each of those times when something new does come about to question our behavior in general, whether it was books or television or whatever it might be. This is a chance to take stock and sort of be purposeful about whatever it is that we are using and to talk about it, whereas these things so quickly become the norm without a chance to sort of discuss what do we want our lives to be.
I'd like to actually get to some listener telephone calls and comments because they're really stacking up here. We're touching a nerve. First of all, Rachel from Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good. This is a really fascinating conversation to me.
Thank you.
Because I am what anyone would call an extreme social media user. I use it in my work as a publicist, and I use it in my personal life. And in my school district, we have a very, very engaged community, and we have a forum, and it's, boy, this conversation's been flying recently because we've been through some stuff. So I have a couple of thoughts about what you're saying. One is that it can be extremely stressful, particularly when I'm in a situation where I'm posting about something, and we tend to disagree. So there can be that emotional reaction, just like you'd have any time you disagree with someone where you care about their feelings. I also find that, of course, it can be a time suck. I work from a home office.
And sure.
That's intense. But the most important thing to me, and I've thought about this a lot, is that when my parents were sick and dying about 5 years ago, I was spending a lot of time at the hospital, a lot of time with them, and it was sort of lonely. It's a very sterile environment. It's a very difficult emotional time. And I was very, very active on Facebook. And I used Facebook as a way to connect with people on the outside and to still feel engaged and also to get the care and nurturance I needed.
I see you nodding your head, Keith.
Yeah, it's never black and white. It's always this give and take. And I think that this is an extremely good example of some of the benefits and potentially some of the costs, too. I mean, all that advantage in terms of social support when it's time of need and the ability to share those positive and negative events has a lot of advantages, not just for stress, but for empathy and for our participation in our communities. So I think that that's all very true. And the one thing that, you know, is a little bit concerning is it is true that we are spending, I think, more time engaging with diverse audiences and being aware of people who do disagree with us around issues that, say, their local school board issues or other community issues or political issues, where we think that those around us should agree with us and we're finding disagreement. And I think that we are learning as a society for the first time and how to deal with such diversity and how to deal with disagreement in ways that are both civil and productive.
It's different, though, in this day and age. You might have, you know, 30 years ago, told somebody something on the phone that you knew would get reaction, but now you're doing it to the whole village. You vent online and you have hundreds of quote-unquote friends who are seeing this, and the reaction can be that much bigger.
Yeah, it really is a sea change. I mean, when we used to have concerns that our opinions weren't well-formed or we were trying to form a new attitude, we would go to our closest friends and family and we would tell them, you know, how we were feeling. And because they're our closest friends and family, they would tend to agree with us and they would give us this wonderful positive affirmation and it would reaffirm our opinions. That's not the same as sharing that on Facebook with a wide group of folks or sharing it to the local bulletin board for the school board. There you're likely to meet some disagreement, people who are both completely rational in how they disagreed and those who are going to be more boisterous. And learning how to share and gaining from that is a new skill that I think we are starting to develop.
All right. Thanks, Rachel, for the telephone call. Let's go to Kim in Westchester. Hello, Kim.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I'm a family counselor in private practice, and I work with age groups from adolescents to really the elderly. And I think it's hard to argue that there aren't some benefits to technology, such as, you know, the connection for people who are isolated and the flexibility for working parents. What I think the purposefulness and intentionality is really the key that I have a lot of, you know, I see a lot of people who, for instance, have their arguments via text, you know, rather than face-to-face. And I think some of it is because, you know, their conflict avoidance, it seems safer, but also just not taking time to consider, is this beneficial to me? Is this helpful? Is it really working? And, you know, as far as the inner life and the time to think, I feel what I see is very quick reactions when people are using technology, as you've mentioned. So I guess I'm just sort of validating what I'm hearing, that I think some people are using technology in a very unhealthy way, which definitely adds to their stress level. But I wouldn't, be comfortable saying, technology has to go and it's interfering with our lives in,
sure,
only negative ways. The kids I'm especially concerned about because they don't have the comparison. They don't remember what it was like before, all this instant technology. So they really, it's hard for them to be intentional and discern. So,
thanks, Kim, for the call. You've touched on a number of important points. And again, when it comes to learning how to interact on a human level, if you have news to impart, it's just easier sometimes to text somebody or to email them, is it not? As opposed to looking at somebody in the eye and learning the social cues and et cetera?
I think so. I mean, there certainly are a lot of advantages to the anytime, anywhere accessibility of mobile phones. I mean, it's hard not to gain from the ability to, send my wife will send me a text saying, please pick up bread on the way home, and that'll save a lot of coordination time. So there's certainly instrumental goods, but being able to share those little emotional tidbits throughout your day is really advantageous. That said, using willpower to be able to resist the need to immediately respond to someone when they say something that might be insensitive to you or to confront your point of view can be very, very difficult. And the risk of that, I think we all know, is that we say things that we, kind of come to regret later. And it certainly is a skill to learn how to wait a few minutes, mm-hmm, breathe deeply, and then decide, when to respond in an appropriate way and through an appropriate channel. I mean, it may not always be the right way to respond back through that text message. It may be time to actually pick up the phone and make a phone call, or actually maybe even go see someone in person.
Manish, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I'm a working mom and I really depend on my phone, but I am concerned that people also think, because they don't have to look someone in the eye, they can say something. We did a program about racism on Facebook and surveyed people, and there was a very large percentage that said that they had seen something that had a racist overtone in their Facebook feed. And we spoke to a researcher who said, it's not the ones that are overtly racist. Those get called out pretty quickly.
Sure.
It's the ones that are very subtle and that have a sort of insidious effect.
All right, we're up against a break, but we are back with more on Radio Times, how digital technology affects our lives. Again, join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowane. Back in just a bit. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowane. Keith Hampton is co-author of a new Pew study, which has found that social media might actually help to relieve stress in some situations. And Manush Zomorodi is host of the WNYC podcast, New Tech City. Our number is 888-477-9499. Email radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So, Keith, I'd like to get into the study a little bit more. Let's tease out gender differences. Again, we got into it a bit earlier. Women tend to experience perhaps less if they're on Facebook. Maybe it can help them relieve stress. Let's talk about how men react again, and why is the difference? Did your study look into that at all?
Yeah, so we were very aware of the different gender differences here. There's a lot going on. So we know, for example, that women tend to report higher levels of kind of baseline stress than men do to begin with. We are also very aware that men and women tend to use technology very differently. So women, for example, use Facebook much more intensively than men do, whereas men are also more likely to self-select for some technologies, such as LinkedIn, for example. Women are more likely to be on Pinterest, and all of this relates to how women become aware of different events in the lives of friends and family. So women, much more aware, even to begin with, of the of things happening in lives of friends and family, both positive events and negative events. Men, at least 20% kind of less aware of these events going on around them to start with.
And that's just the way we're wired?
It's a really good question. I don't know if it's how we're wired. I don't know if it's environmental. I'm not sure if it's just a historical artifact, but certainly men do seem to be much less aware. of events, particularly in the lives of close friends and family.
Okay, let's get back to listener comments. David in Mount Airy asks, how do businesses deal with phone usage? It must have an impact on their productivity. Manoush, what do you think?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, one of the challenges that we're having is called a focation, where we are having people create out-of-office replies for as little as an hour or maybe the whole day where they say, you know what, I'm just not available. And then they go and relax or they try to get some real work done. And part of the reason why we came up with that was because of Leslie Perlow. She's a professor at Harvard Business School who did some work with Boston Consulting Group where they had several consultants take one day a week to sort of be offline. And they saw that not only did their teams work better together, they overall, there was more retention at the corporation itself. And now here we are 10 years later from when she tried this out on one group of consultants. I think it was a group of seven. And now this, it's called PTO, is in, I believe, 70 of their offices around the globe so that they make sure that there is time to unplug, that there is time to spend with family, time to do real thinking, time to have an inner life and maybe an outer life. And that all in all, it's been a very positive thing for BCG. And I Fortune ranked them, I think, number 3 in office happiness for people who, you know, satisfaction, job satisfaction.
Fascinating. Keith, you're smiling.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I even try and practice in my own life. I mean, I have a hard rule of no email past 6 o'clock at night, and now I'm trying to move that into no email on Sundays. But whether or not I can stick to that is going to be
Keith, you're doing your own Bored and Brilliant project.
I know, I know.
Yourself.
Well, you know, it's actually not Bored and Brilliant. It's trying to be, you know, aware of what's happening with my children more than anything else, and making sure that I make time to spend with them.
Okay, we've got a text from Wei Zhu. I believe there's a difference between stress from immediate tech use and from overall tech use. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we can all think of kind of instances where technology induces a kind of quick rush of stress that may dissipate, you know, fairly rapidly. But, you know, I certainly had that experience on my way here driving on the turnpike. It wasn't social media driven, but it was certainly tractor trailer driven. Uh-huh. And there are a lot of these little kind of instantaneous stressors that happen throughout the day. And, you know, that is probably not good for us. But a lot of that kind of evens out over the day, over the week, in our lives in general. And certainly the findings of this study suggest that people who are using these technologies intensively compared to those who don't use them all or just use them a little bit, that your everyday life is probably not more stressful as a result.
Okay. Let's get back to human interaction. Keith, you updated studies done by sociologist William White and his assistant Fred Kent, which were done back in the 60s and 70s. And they looked at a number of urban spaces, including Chestnut Street in Philly, by the way. And what did you find in terms of changes?
Right. So we were really interested in knowing whether the social life of streets has changed over the last 30 years ago. So we studied a series of parks and public spaces in New York City and Boston and here in Philadelphia. And we analyzed content of videotape that had been taken 30 years ago of those same spaces to video taken more recently of those spaces. And we looked at whether people were walking in groups more or less, whether they were in more diverse groups than they were in the past. And we were very interested, you know, in what big, large-scale changes might be responsible for how people are changing their everyday lives in public spaces. And what we found was somewhat surprising. Mobile phone use, while certainly new compared to 30 years ago, wasn't taking over public spaces as much as we expected. For the most part, it was relatively uncommon that there was a subset of people using it. They weren't using it in groups. They were using it in times and spaces where they were more likely to be alone. The big difference over 30 years really was the rise of women. There were many more women in public spaces than there were 30 years ago, and men and women spending more time in public than in the past. And, you know, that's really something that we thought, you know, must have happened so much earlier. But to see that it has changed so dramatically over 30 years was certainly a surprise.
Okay. So you weren't seeing the negative image of the mom or the dad sitting in, you know, next to the stroller or with the toddler running around, but not looking at the child, looking at the smartphone, or sitting side by side in the bench, you know, and not looking at each other, but looking down.
You know, you certainly see it. So we did another
study. Not as much, though, as you know.
It wasn't as common as we thought it would be.
Okay.
It represents, in general, less than 10% of people in a public space using any kind of mobile device at any moment in time. But we did try and observe this more intensely through studies in Rittenhouse Square and some other public spaces where we sat there and we spent literally hours watching just over 1,300 people using different media, using their laptops, their mobile phones, reading books. And what we found was that, you know, mobile phone use really isn't that different from reading a book in public space, that using the internet in public really isn't that different than other media that were there before, that these people are certainly less aware of what's happening around them, but they're also attracting more and more people to these spaces. And that has a lot of advantages in terms of the safety of our public spaces and the diversity of those spaces.
Manoush? What do you think?
Oh, I love the idea that there's more women out there in public. That's just incredibly gratifying to hear.
It's an interesting snapshot, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really sort of what Keith is saying, what he's studied, really drives home the point to me that the 11,000 people who have signed up for Bored and Brilliant are very, very much self-selecting. And, you know, we know, according to Pew, that 58% of Americans have smartphones. Obviously, 99% of the ones who signed up for our project have smartphones. And also, I think this is interesting, 48% of them have advanced degrees. 75% of them are women. The average age is 36. So we're definitely looking at a group of people who are feeling the pressures from their smartphone, or at least want to rethink their relationship with it and be more purposeful about it. As Keith says, that's not necessarily the majority of the population, but there is a group of these people, and they are smart, they are educated, and they are struggling. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens as we do that week of sort of experiments on ourselves.
Manoush, you mentioned that you have children. How are you teaching them to work with digital technology?
You know, I'm really concerned about this. I was talking about autobiographical planning, that thing that happens when your mind wanders.
Sure.
And I see that, you know, that worries me that if kids don't take the time to sort of think what they're doing beyond tomorrow, that they aren't going to set goals. For me, I would almost rather that they watch a movie that has a narrative, that has an arc, that has a lesson, where they see people talking and interacting, than play a game, even though I get so... It seems like there's every other day there's a study that says playing games increases, you know, they need to know for the future what kind of jobs they can get. You need to be able to do these things. I think that stuff will come. So I'm not pushing it on my kids any sooner than it sort of needs to trickle into it. I think let's learn the basic skills first about talking and explaining and really being the human skills, the social skills, before we get to that other stuff. I mean, the other thing that I think about is the Gamergate issue that happened over the last 6 months, where women were really being harassed and threatened online by majority male, young male people attacking female journalists who cover games. And that I find that very scary that this is tolerated online. And so I want to go with the human stuff as a parent first, and then we'll get to the other digital stuff.
The human stuff, are there time constraints? Do you think that with children you need to just say, okay, it is now time to come off this stuff for, say, 3 hours? And Keith, let's get you into the conversation, too. You mentioned you have kids. How are you working that, Manoush?
So for me, there's... you know, I'm not going to say that I don't give them the phone on a Saturday morning when I need to clean out the dishwasher and do a million things. I absolutely do, but I'm trying to be very mindful of the amount of time, so setting limits on it. And also, you know, when they complain and bellyache, I'm so bored, I have nothing to do. Like, okay, let them bellyache. You don't need to keep them constantly stimulated, because this is when the good stuff can kick in.
Let them be bored.
Yeah, let them be bored, because I think, where I live in Brooklyn, parents are all about getting their kids to Mandarin class and swimming and brain teasers and all those things. Like, there's something to be said for hanging around and doing nothing, like I did in the burbs in the 70s.
Keith?
Yeah, absolutely. I share the same level of concern with my children. We are very cognitive of how much time they're spending on their devices, and we work to limit that time. We also work to limit the amount of time they spend in other extracurricular activities, too. I mean, we actually purposely avoid going to a number of different events every week, keeping them, you know, up too late. But we also, you know, keep them off television and sometimes actually do redirect them to games where they do spend more time interacting with their friends and learning creativity in ways that we never expected.
I'd like to also like to address, before the hour wraps up, one of the positives of being online is that folks who are uncomfortable with social contact, folks who are isolated, actually do have a way that enables them to relate to people in a way that's, you know, that works for them. Keith, what have you found?
Yeah, absolutely. One of our prior studies with Pew Research, we looked in depth at how use of technology was related to social isolation, the number of really close, intimate relationships that people have, and even the diversity of their overall social networks. And we found that people who were using these technologies the most were less likely to be socially isolated. They had more close friends. They also had, you know, more diverse social relationships on the whole.
And also the way you use Facebook can matter. A Carnegie Mellon study has found that people who are active, you post, you like things, their sense of loneliness apparently decreases. But if you're passive, not so much.
Yeah, we're finding actually the exact same thing. It's really about posting behavior in particular, that the more status updates people make, the more social support they tend to feel that they have. That some of the kind of less directly active forms of social media don't seem to bring the same benefits.
Okay. I'd like to get to this email from Jurger. This is actually kind of cute. Regarding your conversation, I'm always amazed at the number of people, mostly young but not all, who constantly check or text while working out at the gym. Many of these people spend 30 seconds completing a set and then 3 minutes or more sitting on a machine texting. No sweat. So I just thought that was cute and probably reflective of the attraction of cell phones as opposed to a hard set. And this other tweet from Ron, which is on a more serious note, he says, and we address this a little bit, reflection is declining in our society. Technology has become intrusive and there are no quiet spaces anymore. Which is a broad statement, but that is probably, I'm guessing, Manoush, reflective of some of the sentiment that you're finding with the folks who've joined up for your challenge.
Yeah, you know, I think especially here in New York City, where people spend a lot of time on the subway, there's, you know, I love looking at my phone when I'm on the subway because it makes the time go so much more quickly. But then I'm like, you know what? Time's going pretty fast as it is. Maybe that's not a good thing. And maybe I need to take that 20 minutes to sort of think through why my colleague and I disagreed on something and how I could approach it differently tomorrow. Or maybe think through, like, maybe there's a meal I want to plan this weekend and it's kind of complex, but let's do it, you know? Or maybe it's even something bigger. Maybe it's, you know, coming up with a 20-year goal for myself. All of that has got to be better than getting to another level of Candy Crush, or in my case, two dots, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to not just reach into my pocket like I have been reflexively. And I think there's, from what we've heard from so many people who've signed up for this project, they're ready to give that a try too. And of course, you know, what feels right for a 16-year-old isn't going to be the same for a 65-year-old grandmother. You know, every person has to figure out what's right. But let's remind ourselves of the good stuff that can happen without our phones too. And so that maybe we'll even appreciate our phones more after this.
Keith?
Absolutely. I think this is the really attractive thing about Manoush's project, is that it may not just be about the technology, but by providing that opportunity to break out of our regular patterns and reflect on our everyday activities and how these technologies fit into other aspects of our lives with our friends and family. I think that these types of projects are extremely good at providing us with those opportunities.
All right. On that note, we have to wrap it up. Keith Hampton is an associate professor in the Department of Communication at Rutgers University and co-author of a new Pew study, which has found that time spent online might actually reduce stress. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you.
And Manoush Zomorodi is host of the WNYC podcast, New Tech City, which is launching a project called Bored and Brilliant, The Lost Art of Spacing Out. It was a pleasure, Manoush.
Oh, it was so fun, Mary. Thank you.
We invite you to join us on Facebook and Twitter. And you can also find our podcast by heading to whyy.org/radiotimes. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain.